Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
Even though you make payroll every Friday, you don't have a guaranteed paycheck. You're the owner, and you eat what you kill.
We are back. 13 after. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this show is dedicated to providing small business owners with the maximum opportunity to be successful. And it's for dreamers, too. If you are dreaming about, if you're thinking about, scheming about, planning, you wake up in the middle of the night, you go to sleep and you wake up in the middle of the night and you wake up in the morning thinking about being a small business owner, hang around, listen up. This show's for you, too, because I was a dreamer once myself, and I know how it is. Let me tell you who our special guest is this hour. His name is Bert Folsom. Bert's our friend. He's a member of our Brain Trust. He's formerly with the Mackinac Center,
right,
out of Midland, Michigan, and now he's got a new job. Bert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be back.
And you're now with the Center for the American Idea out of Houston, Texas.
That is exactly right.
Take a half a minute and tell us about what the Center for the American Idea is.
We notice in society we have a lot of ignorance in economics, but also in history. And what we're trying to do is provide the foundation blocks in history and economics, especially for teachers and public school, private school teachers, because if we can straighten out a lot of the misinformation that is dispensed among the teachers, then they can bring it back to the classroom and we can restore a lot of sanity to the teaching of history and economics in the schools in America today.
I am so glad to hear that you guys are focusing on that. I got a little, you sent me a little bit of information, just a
sure.
few little bit of tidbits, and I sort of, because you mentioned that this new job was giving you the chance to work with schools and with children, and I sort of thought that that might be what you guys were working on. I'm glad to hear that because, as you and I know, and some of the things that we're going to talk about as we move through the hour today, is how our workforce is having to change, how their attitude,
sure,
the culture of our workforce is having to change. It's got some of us old heads, some folks who are my age or older, and have not been actually involved in business, but have really been an employee all their lives. Some of those old heads are not going to change as well, and you guys, it sounds to me like you guys are planting some seeds that you hope to bear fruit in the next 10, 20 years or so.
Absolutely, Jim. If we can, as I say, provide some essential foundations, the building blocks of economics and history, people can then understand the past, they can understand how the economy works, and those students can then go on to be productive members of the American society.
Well, and you know, I'm also excited about some other things that are going on in the marketplace, and that is the relationship that businesses through their various organizations, like chambers of commerce and other entities, who are working with high schools, they're working with junior colleges and colleges and four-year
right.
schools to integrate the things into the colleges and the schools to develop and to let these administrators know what the workforce needs, the way the marketplace is changing so rapidly. These people have to have, the people who develop the curriculum, they've got to have some kind of contact with the marketplace, and that's happening all over the country right now. It's very exciting.
I think it is, and you see that with organizations like Junior Achievement, Steve Mariotti also with his NFTE group out of New York City,
mm-hmm.
trying to help students become more competent in the way they think about economics to make them absolutely more productive in society.
Well, you know, when you and I were going to high school, basically you were on two tracks. You were on a trade school track where you're going to graduate and you were going to have a trade and go to maybe go to a technical college or something like that and become an employee,
right?
Or you maybe you took some of the advanced courses, some of the college prep courses in high school, and on your way to become to go to a college and a liberal arts college or something like that. But now those things are kind of, the lines are a little bit blurry now, aren't they?
They are a little bit. And you know what? I think that they have been always a little bit more blurred than people think, because a lot of the most successful entrepreneurs in our society started out as manual laborers.
Yeah.
They started off in the, you look 100 years ago, the two wealthiest people in American society were Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Carnegie started out working as a manual laborer in a textile mill, and Rockefeller was the son of an itinerant peddler.
These weren't people born to the manor, were they?
They certainly were not. They had a very, very strong understanding of what it meant to be a manual laborer, not just a skilled laborer, but really an unskilled laborer out there in the workforce for a while. But
we think of those names. We think of blue bloods all the way back to the Magna Carta or something like that. And that's really not the case, is it?
No, that was the first generation of those families. And the first effective generation in this country of those families. Carnegie was an immigrant. He came over from Scotland.
Right.
So what you have here are people who have an understanding of what it's like to in this case actually be manual laborers and then work up to be more skilled, and then enter the entrepreneur area as a white collar worker. So I think that there's been really more of a blurring of that in our past than sometimes people think.
Maybe I see your point. And folks, if you're wondering how Bert Folsom knows all this stuff and why I consider him to be an expert, I'm holding a book that's called The Myth of the Robber Barons, A New Look at the Rise of Big Business in America, and it's in its third edition, and it's by Bert W. Folsom, Jr. He's also the author of Empire Builders, How Michigan Entrepreneurs Helped Create, Helped Make America Great, and that's also by Bert Folsom. So this guy is, Bert spent his time, he's spent the time researching and creating the documents on this information. Bert, let's talk a little bit about Labor Day for a second.
Sure.
And I got some information on Labor Day here, and the information that I have is that it got started in the 1880s.
That's right.
It's not sure. There was a McGuire in there somewhere. We don't know if it was Peter or Matthew, and they spell their names differently, but they sounded the same, McGuire. But it pretty much is understood that the Labor Day movement began in New York.
That's true. It was a group called the Knights of Labor, which was a major industrial union back in the 1800s.
Yep.
And absolutely, New York City, 1882, the first Labor Day celebration in New York City.
September 5th. Stand by, Bert. We're going to take a break. Folks, it's 20 after the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk some more to Bert Folsom about labor and Labor Day and how it all got started. 888-822-8255. All right, we are back. It's 24 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. 888-822-8255. That's our phone number. And our website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Bert Folsom is our special guest. He's our good friend. He works with the Center for the American Idea. And Bert, have you got a website?
Yes, we do. www.americanidea.org.
.org, and that's American Idea altogether.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, good. And we'll get you to talk to us a little bit more about that in a minute. But what I want to do, I want to get back into our conversation about the origins of Labor Day. Apparently the first one was on a Tuesday, September the 5th, 1982, in New York City. Then that was just a local thing that a bunch of guys got together and said, hey, let's have our Labor Day. And then over the next decade or so, I think in 1894, 23 states had adopted Labor Day as a holiday, and then on June 28th of that year of 1894, Congress passed an act, and here's the language, folks, making the first Monday in September of each year a legal holiday, and this is the language I like, in the District of Columbia and the territories. I thought that was an interesting way to put that.
That is.
Of course, that was their perspective in those days. The states were not as organized. In fact, we still had a lot of territories which we don't have today.
That's right. Yeah, and it's a good time of the year to have it too. In the fall, for the farmers, the harvest.
Yeah, exactly.
You think of the harvest coming in, but also it's the last in many parts of the country, the last really good time when you have excellent weather and can enjoy the outdoors.
Right, exactly.
Good time for a holiday.
I wish they'd have it on Friday, though.
Oh, okay.
I like Friday. In fact, I'm gonna call the president and see if we can't work that out. I like Friday holidays better than Monday holidays. Okay. Monday holidays are just kind of, I don't know, because then Tuesday becomes a Monday. See, when you go back to work on Tuesday, it's like Monday, and I don't like Tuesdays that seem like Mondays.
Of course, you still get 3 days for a holiday, Jim.
Well, I know, but I'd rather have it on Friday. See, there's just something about being off Friday too that,
oh, okay,
that makes a difference. I don't mean Friday and Monday, just Friday. Anyway,
okay.
I'll have to talk to Bill about that. Talk to us. I'd like for you to talk to us a little bit, Bert, about the Department of Labor.
Sure.
What do you tell us? What you know about the Department of Labor?
Well, you might be interested. The Labor Day as a holiday occurred long before a Department of Labor was ever set up.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Labor is a function of this century, 1913, and what you have is a recognition that the manual labor, skilled laborers, working people are important, and that cabinet level officials ought to deal with people working in those types of jobs. And so that comes in 1913.
Well, were the tensions building, or were they at any kind of a fever pitch in 1913 with regard to industry and labor in those days?
As a matter of fact, we had some major strikes in Colorado, and Colorado, by the way, was the first state to have Labor Day as a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there were some major strikes in Colorado. I'm not sure if that directly, if there's a cause and effect between that and the creation of Labor Day as a holiday. But there was some industrial unrest at that time.
Well, I was just wondering about that. And of course, the next two or three decades really got the relationship between labor and management deteriorated considerably, didn't it?
If you're thinking about the Great Depression, it sure did.
Well, I was thinking about all the strikes and of course the advent of organized labor.
Yeah,
because organized labor really became strong in the mid part of the century. The what was it? Probably the 30s and 40s.
Yes, the Wagner Act in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to separate here organized labor and non-organized labor.
Right.
And the balance of power shifted in the direction of organized labor after the passage of the Wagner Act in the 1930s, because then you had mandatory collective bargaining, and employers had to negotiate with labor unions.
With the advent of the Wagner Act?
Yes, with the advent of the Wagner Act in 1935. So when the balance of power was shifted toward organized labor, that changed the workplace very much.
Did the passage of the Wagner Act create? Did it solve some problems, or did it for a short period of time, say a few years, did it create a lot of problems?
It created a lot of problems simply because whenever you mandate that employers have to negotiate,
mm-hmm.
and you get the wage hikes that come with that,
yeah.
you run the risk of businesses becoming uncompetitive. And
right.
that's what happened, for example, in the auto industry.
Mm-hmm.
No one could top the American auto industry. Ford and GM led the world, and they led it by a mile.
Stand by, Bert. We've got to take a quick break. Folks, it's 29 after the hour. We're going to talk a little bit more about this, and I want to ask Bert a couple more questions about the Department of Labor when we come back right after these messages. I'm Jim Blassingen, the Small Business Advocate. We are back. It's 33 after. Welcome back, heroes. Thank you for joining us. And you're listening to the show that is dedicated to providing small business owners with a maximum opportunity to succeed. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Bert Folsom is our special guest, and we're talking about Labor Day. We're talking about labor and how it got its origins, and specifically, Bert, we were talking a little bit about the Department of Labor.
Right.
How it got started, and everything started in 1913, as you told us, and you were mentioning a little bit about the Wagner Act, and my father and my mother were both members of labor unions. They
interesting. I didn't know that, Jim.
Oh yeah, and my dad was a member of a labor union on the railroad. And he was also a member of a labor union as a employee of a steel company, a steel mill. And Standard Forgings was the name of the steel mill in Gary, Indiana. And then he worked, and as I said, he worked for the railroad for a long time. And my mother was a member of a union when we lived in Indiana with Illinois Bell. And she was a member of she was an operator,
okay.
a telephone operator. And so I grew up in a union household.
Absolutely.
Now I've never been a member of a union, But I have studied a little bit about it. I remember reading about some of the things that happened, and I remember how important the unions have been to this country. How important, and in so many ways, they have. There are plenty of examples where unions have been important to the American worker, and it'd be interesting to contemplate what the landscape would be like, Bert, without unions this century. But just one more thing, and then I'll let you respond. And that is, I do have to say, though, in my opinion, and this is where I'm, you know, I may offend some folks, but that's okay.
The son of a union.
I'm a son of a union, but I've never been a member of a union, and I have to question the future of unions.
Sure.
Now,
I think I'd want to distinguish here between just a union and then a union, an organized labor under collective bargaining, where
okay.
the advantages are tilted in their favor. I think that, in fact, most economists, you know, Henry Hazlitt, you go back even Adam Smith, those types of people, tend to, free market thinkers, always said, well, it's fair enough to organize. You can advance your wages and that kind of thing. And in a neutral sort of setting, it can be a very fair process. What we often have, though, with collective bargaining is an unfair process where the management has to agree to accept a union and then has to agree to accept certain changes as a result. And so that's a little bit of an unfair situation.
Right.
Another thing to point to keep in mind is that unions tend to keep out their opponent is not always the employer. It's often other types of laborers.
Mm-hmm.
They want to limit the market. It's like an entrepreneur does not want other entrepreneurs in that field competing with him.
Right.
Laboring
which
groups,
which entrepreneurs do not have the ability to do.
Right.
If somebody wants to open up another flower shop next door to my flower shop, they can do it.
They absolutely can. After the Wagner Act, it gets more restrictive with organized labor, and they are able to keep people out much more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to consider. Their enemies are often other types of workers who might compete with them, and a lot of major strikes in this country have been directed at other workers and not so much at the employers.
Right. Now, these other workers who just choose not to organize, or the people who cross the picket lines?
Well, I'm thinking of either one.
Uh-huh.
Of course, people who cross the picket lines are the real enemy of...
And they have a very, very disparaging name that they've developed for that. I remember my father talking about that.
Yeah, the word scab, I'm sure,
scab.
In the Lessingham household was not a pleasant name.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
But if you think about it, these are just people trying to put their labor on the market.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
right.
I think I can produce the product at a better price for everybody.
Well, let's take something that's kind of modern day here and talk about the umpires. Have you been following that?
Oh, yes.
The baseball umpires.
That is an interesting development, isn't it?
Well, you know, exactly. I've been, and of course, the players and the owners basically ran me off in '94when they had their strike. And when the owners forced or whatever caused the strike, people ask me why I don't watch baseball anymore, and I tell them because two World Wars and a Great Depression didn't cause us not to have a World Series, but the greed of the players and the owners did in '94,
yes.
And I haven't been able to get into it since then. But the interesting thing to me, I have been following the strike a little bit, and the interesting thing to me is that one of the I heard recently that one of the guys who actually wound up losing his job was a rookie umpire. Now I've got to question
sure.
a guy who's just been elevated to that position. I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, he paid his dues for many, many years, I'm sure, in the 1A and 2A and 3A farm leagues, making $3,000 a month for only the months that he worked, not for a full year salary. And then he gets to the show, and because Richie Phillips says he needs to strike or resign or whatever, he does it. I've got to question that.
That's right.
I think that's a bad plan. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. And historically, organized labor has been under the direction of people who have made bad decisions. Remember the Patco strike?
Yeah. 1981? Oh, yeah. That was the air traffic controllers.
Air traffic controllers.
I was flying a lot in those days. I'm a pilot, and I don't fly as much these days. But back in those days, I was flying a lot. And I remember working with what they would have called the scabs in the towers. It was interesting.
Your father would have been ashamed of you, Jim.
He probably would have been. Stand by. It's 39 after. That's not the only thing he's probably ashamed of me for. I'm Jim Blasingen, the Small Business Advocate. We'll be right back with Bert Folsom. We're back. It's 44 after. I'm Jim Blasingen, the Small Business Advocate. And I want to tell you, I told you earlier in the hour, who is going to be coming up later this week. Let me tell you who's coming up later in the month. We got a star-packed month this month. Cherie Carter-Scott's going to be with us later in the month to talk to us about her book, If Life is a Game, These Are the Rules. Paul Goldner's going to be back with us to talk to us about the Ten Commandments of Selling. Knight Kiplinger, the president of Kiplinger, the Kiplinger Organization, the Kiplinger Letters, and the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. He's going to be joining us later in the month to give us his ideas on his perspectives on where we are in as we end up this century and where we're headed as we go into the next century. Roger Volcom is going to be back with us to talk to us about being better negotiators. Also, Jack Halber is going to be back with us to talk to us about a little bit more about salesmanship. Mark Allen is going to be back to talk to us about visionary business and a lot of other good folks. And I'm looking forward to visiting with those and sharing some ideas with them. Bert Folsom is our guest this hour. He's our good friend, a member of our Brain Trust, and he's with the organization called the Center for the American Idea out of Houston, Texas. Bert, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about the Labor Department, and then we're going to get into some of the roles that entrepreneurs have played in the labor movement in this country.
Sure.
I'm looking at the address or the message, I should say, that I got off the internet from Secretary Herman, Alexis M. Herman, Secretary of Labor, and I'm also remembering some comments that were made this morning in the news in Talk America Radio Network's news. Deb Daigle reported that that Secretary Herman was saying, she was talking about giving her Labor Day address, and she was saying something about organized labor is doing well too. In fact, that it is actually has won more organizations than they've lost lately. Now, here's my question. Is it her role, and I'm asking this very honestly,
sure,
Secretary Herman's role to be an advocate for organized labor?
Well, absolutely not. First of all, there are only about 12% of the country of the labor force that fits into that.
Right.
And you're not supposed to advocate any more than a Secretary of Commerce should advocate Ford Motors over General Motors or over Chrysler or one of the others.
But it was clear to me, I mean, the comment was, you know, organized labor has a lot to be you know, excited about these days, and that
there's the implication that the advances that have come in the labor field have been as a result of unions.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
There are many, many instances where that's not true.
Yeah.
First of all, you have the entrepreneurs who are providing the jobs. And the more variety of jobs you have, the more the market forces can work in to raise the wages and offer different choices for laborers. But more than that, if you look at this historically, the 40-hour week and the minimum wage have come from Ford Motor Company,
mm-hmm,
in 1913.
Well, now, the minimum wage also, didn't you tell me once that the minimum wage also came as a result of textile jobs going south and the
absolutely
some of the big players and the politicians in the New England area getting that pushed through Congress?
Right, I had that article in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, that's how I first met you, wasn't it? Yeah,
that's how we first met.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly right. When the government came involved, it was the New England textile owners who were upset because of the competition coming from Southerners.
Right.
And so in order to keep the Southerners out of the market and keep the textile mills in New England, you have a minimum wage that prevents the Southern laborers from offering their labor at a cheaper rate.
Right. Where do you see organized labor 10 years from now? What did we have, 20-something percent probably 20 years ago? Maybe 30 years ago? What was the percentages of labor back in 1970?
Are you thinking of organized labor?
Organized labor. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you had a much higher percentage, close to 30%.
Yeah, and now it's 12%. So that's not a good trend. And even though they may be making a few gains, what do you see the percentage being 10 years from now? Look into your crystal ball there.
It's hard to tell, but the direction has been downward over the last 30 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, probably it may continue that way. The more variety of jobs we have, the more choice we have, the more we have international trade, have all in some ways worked against the system of unions, and so we are likely to see that trend continue. Obviously, Secretary Herman thinks perhaps that's not the case.
Well, you know,
I can't think of any specifics that would indicate why that wouldn't continue to happen.
That, I'm sure that was her political statement to throw a bone to the unions. You know,
it could be.
They have to do that sort of thing, but the thing that's interesting to me, Bert, if you look at the landscape of the marketplace, and you realize that in this decade, there have been a net loss of jobs from major corporations, but a net gain overall of over 12 million new jobs, then that tells you that the entrepreneurs, the small business people, have created the new jobs, and those companies, while they may become large one day, are not really all that large today, probably. You know, they may be two or three people,
right.
They may be 100 people, and that's not really fertile soil for organizing, is it?
No, it isn't. You're absolutely right. And if you look at a lot of the changes in some of those unions, coal mining, for example, the United Mine Workers was one of the early and strong unions, and it's not nearly as strong today. The technology has changed the industry tremendously. It's
yep.
made it safer and less dangerous.
Well, there's not as many people either.
Yep.
Yeah. Stand by, Bert. We're going to take a break, folks. We're going to come back and wrap up the hour with Bert on this Labor Day. Bert Folsom is our special guest, and he is with the Center for the American Idea. I'm Jim Blessingham, the Small Business Advocate. Don't go away. We are back. 54 after. I'm Jim Blessingham, the Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com, and that's where you can go to not only learn more about Bert Folsom, and a little bit more about me if you should ever happen to want to do that, and about the show. But you can also go to hear the show live on the Internet. You can also hear the show on demand on the Internet. And stay tuned, because in a few short weeks, we're going to have something really powerful on the website, and I'm very excited about it. Bert, let's wrap up the hour by I want to talk a little bit about technology and small business and technology and the labor force, because I know that's something you guys are working on. But before I do, I want to mention something real quickly. At DOL.gov, folks, that's the Department of Labor. It's interesting, Bert, to see what that page looks like. There is nothing, the words that are repeated more on the homepage of the Department of Labor
right.
than any other term on the Department of Labor's homepage are these two words, small business. Isn't that interesting?
That's absolutely interesting.
I'm looking at their homepage, and here it is. It says the Small Business Initiative, and it's talking about the drug-free and alcohol-free workplace. They've got the Small Business Initiative link there. Then they've got employment laws assistance for workers and small businesses. And then the Department of Labor Small Business Regulatory Compliance Assistance page. These are three links. There is no other organization, sentient being, group, whatever you might want to call it,
sure.
that is more represented on the Department of Labor's homepage than small business. And I don't see anything that says anything about organized labor. That's very interesting to me.
Well, it's something about the American dream. It has not been to work in a factory for somebody else. It's been to have your own business.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that there's not plenty of things about organized labor in some of the other pages. I'm talking about just what's evident on the homepage. Doesn't that tell you what the government is thinking about the way America is going?
I think so.
And not just America, but the globe.
Yeah, nonetheless, even though that's probably true, that's still a surprise.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it kind of was to me, too, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up. But and let me tell you one other thing. In Secretary Herman's, and this is why I'm excited about what you're doing, Bert, in Secretary Herman's Labor Day message that I got off the website, their website, she mentions technology or related technology terms five times in probably only about three-quarters of a page.
Right.
Now, that tells you that obviously they understand what kind of emphasis that there's going to be on those who work in the marketplace as an employee, and that's what you're focusing a lot on, I'm sure, aren't you?
It is. Technological change is generated, though, often by the entrepreneurs to cut costs.
Yep.
And then it has that kind of impact on the industry itself. The textile mills do not have the noisy shuttles and a lot of the unhealthy conditions about the cotton fibers and all
right.
of this that it had even 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
technology is changing, but the quality of the workplace is improving as a result of it. We have fewer industrial accidents, more healthy conditions.
And you and I, I'm not going to say that we didn't. Some of this didn't start when the labor unions worked hard to get out of the sweatshops and to make conditions safer for everyone.
Sure.
But the mantle has been carried in the last half of this century, or at least the last quarter of this century, in my opinion, more by entrepreneurs than by any other group.
That's true. We'd have to be honest and say that that unions, organized labor, has created some of these changes, but
yep.
a large number have been entrepreneurs,
yep.
entrepreneur-directed, and it has improved the quality of the worker as a result.
Bert, that's got to be the last word, because we've got to wrap it up for this hour. Thank you very much. As always, you did a great job.
Hey, thanks, Jim. It was fun.
See you next time.
Hey, see you
then. And good luck down there in Texas.
Hey, thanks. We'll do it again.
Got to wrap it up for this hour, folks. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest country in the world. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.